With under 3 months till Election Day, the Biden campaign getting pressure to pull out the stops in Texas to seize an historic moment. The story today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown, face-to-face with an interface. In an era of Zoom meetings, Child Protective Services takes family visits online. Presidential rhetoric reconsidered. The Texan author of Demagogue for President makes the case that some of that rhetoric is genius. Listeners have more questions about COVID-19. Dr. Fred Campbell of UT Health San Antonio has more answers. Plus, the week in politics with the Texas Tribune and more when the Texas Standard gets started. Right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this Friday, the 7th day of August, 2020. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us on this last day of what many used to consider a typical work weekend as the Lone Star State ramps up for a return to school. Some sobering news on the state of higher education in Texas. In a story by the Texas Tribune on the financial impact of the pandemic, here's one line that stands out. Texas universities are headed for a financial cliff, and it's anybody's guess how far they will fall. The Texas A&M system is reporting $147 million in lost revenue and pandemic-related expenses so far, while the University of Texas system estimates losses of $131 million, and that's before the governor's mandate to cut costs by another 5% due to an $11.5 billion projected loss in state revenue. Since staff and faculty make up the bulk of university costs, the article projects rounds of layoffs, calling them almost inevitable. More with the Texas Tribune a little later in our broadcast when we review the week in politics. Speaking of politics, with just 3 months left till decision day in what promises to be one of the most contentious presidential election seasons in modern memory, we're starting to see the effect of Texas's role in the contest reconsidered. This week, the campaign of Democratic presumptive nominee Joe Biden announced it bought advertising time in Texas. This being a state that has in recent history often been written off as a presumptive Republican stronghold. Indeed, right now, top Texas Democrats are urging the Biden campaign to seize the moment and pull out the stops in Texas. Brett Jaspers of KERA North Texas has been looking at what that might mean.
Biden first tantalized Democrats when he tossed out a television ad in Texas in mid-July.
I'm thinking of all of you today across Texas. I know the rise in case numbers is causing fear and apprehension.
He followed it up by putting Texas on a list of states that'll share $280 million in political ads this fall. Polls have him running neck and neck in Texas with President Trump, but it's still not certain how forcefully Biden will compete here. So what would a full-fledged campaign require?
Well, you better bring your wallet.
Steve Passwaiter is vice president of Kantar CMAG, which does advertising analysis. The high price of running statewide, he says, has a lot to do with Texas's big four media markets: Dallas-Fort Worth, Houston, Austin, and San Antonio. In 2018, Democrat Beto O'Rourke spent almost $30 million on advertising in his U.S. Senate race, and he lost narrowly. His opponent, Republican Ted Cruz, spent $12.5 million, according to the Wesleyan Media Project. And Passwaiter says there will be even more competition for airtime this year as a wide range of advertisers look to make up ground lost to the coronavirus.
When you get into October and it's the fourth quarter and you've got retailers ramping up for the holidays, there's obviously a lot more demand, and that means prices could be twice as high, could be three times as high.
So clearly, a statewide campaign needs a lot of money for ads. It also needs a strategy for the entire state, according to both Democratic and Republican consultants with experience in Texas. Chris Chudeleon was Bernie Sanders' state director, and before that worked on O'Rourke's presidential and Senate campaigns. He said for O'Rourke's Senate run, they started canvassing too late in the Rio Grande Valley, where many Latino voters live.
We launched a major canvassing program in communities of color only a month and a half before the election. That was when we expanded it. And we had one in the Valley in South Texas as a whole. And the numbers weren't there.
The numbers on election day, that is. Organizing earlier in the valley, says Chu de Leon, could have put O'Rourke over the top in 2018. He also points out Governor Greg Abbott prioritized Latino outreach and won re-election by a wide margin.
So unless Biden shows presence in urban centers and in communities of color, they're not going to necessarily feel this loyalty to Biden or to even turn out in general.
Along those lines, consultant Brian Brown at Red Rock Strategies also thinks truly contesting Texas would require a full state strategy. Brown typically works for Republican candidates. Running ads in just the biggest markets, he says, would limit your message to about two-thirds of voters.
Each media market kind of has its own culture, language, issues, etc., to where you really have to go all in.
There are 20 media markets in Texas. Next, a statewide campaign needs staff, although the national and state parties often share that burden with candidates. Brown put the number of paid staff at around 100, with thousands of volunteers. Chris Chu de Leon thinks Biden would need to hire at least 500 paid staff to compete. Whatever the amount, Brown says staff duties will be different this year.
You can't hold these events in these roundtables. You can't have as many surrogates go to events and speak on your behalf. So it's either the candidate directly through a video conference or paid media, frankly, to reach a lot of these folks.
Brown points out that Texas isn't a coin flip like Florida or Pennsylvania. It hasn't elected a statewide Democrat in 25 years. Mary Beth Rogers was campaign manager for former Governor Ann Richards. She said a campaign starts with the numbers.
I'd really look very hard at the demographic shifts and the cultural changes in the suburbs that surround the largest cities.
And it's possible Biden will spend in Texas not necessarily to win, but to force the president to defend his position. The Trump campaign has announced its own big national ad buy, but so far no ads are bound for Texas. I'm Brett Jaspers in Dallas.
As we've done most weeks during the pandemic, it's time once again to turn to your questions about COVID-19. We've been inviting listeners to send in questions about COVID-19 or what to do about it. And we've been getting some answers from Dr. Fred Campbell. He's a doctor of internal medicine and associate professor of medicine at the Long School of Medicine, UT Health San Antonio. Dr. Campbell, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
It's always great to be with you, David.
This week, all these questions happen to have been sent to us through our website by listeners who declined to share their name with us. So this first one has a question about their workplace. They ask, does running a small desk fan between me and the college students I assist in an open office help prevent COVID-19 spread in my area? I think, in other words, this listener is asking, would moving the air between two people talking, for example, effectively move droplets away from the area?
It appears that being in an open space, particularly with a breeze, will reduce the likelihood of spread of COVID-19 from person to person. So I would think that a fairly powerful fan could do the same thing. And so it would not be a bad idea to have that kind of a situation in a classroom.
Very interesting, because I think about the many people who have, say, gone to the beach and that sort of thing during the pandemic. And some have said, well, once you have those ocean breezes, perhaps that makes it less likely that you're going to come in contact with some of those droplets from others. Is it the same sort of idea?
I believe it is. Of course, you can spread COVID-19 at the beach just like you can anywhere else.
Right.
And that's primarily an issue of being very close to people without other kinds of common sense techniques, such as using a mask and washing hands, that kind of thing.
Right. Now, I've read that soap and water neutralizes COVID-19 on surfaces. Do we need to be concerned with disinfecting and sanitizing surfaces as well? I mean, if so, what's the best method, soap and water or something else?
Disinfectant sprays are all very effective. There's no question about that as far as COVID-19. But my research tells me that soap and water is also a superb way of destroying the virus. The soap will actually make the cover of the virus disintegrate very readily. And so if people prefer to use soap and water, as long as they have a good sudsy solution, there should be no reason why they couldn't use soap and water as a disinfecting solution.
Very interesting. I want to ask you about sneezing. This question is about the best method of doing so. This listener asks, to keep small droplets from spraying, is it better to direct a cough or sneeze onto the floor rather than into the crook of an arm or hands? Do you have any opinion on this matter?
That's a very important practical question. I think that the idea of trying to direct sneezes and coughs immediately into one's arm or hand is probably the most effective way of minimizing the droplet getting into the air and moving a distance. However, there are situations where one can't get the hand or the arm into position quickly enough to minimize the effects of a sneeze or
right.
a cough.
Right.
In that situation, coughing directly down or away from people that could conceivably be affected by your sneezing and coughing would be certainly a very effective way of minimizing COVID spread. You could do both if possible, and that is to sneeze down and to cover one's mouth and nose if possible.
Which only underscores the importance of sanitizing surfaces, even still. We've been talking with Dr. Fred Campbell. He's a doctor of internal medicine at the Long School at UT Health San Antonio. We're having him join us regularly over the course of the coronavirus pandemic to answer your questions. Now, if you have something you'd like to ask, look for us on Twitter, Facebook, or go over to texasstandard.org/coronavirus. And when you get there, you'll find a form to submit your questions. Dr. Campbell, thanks so much for joining us again. Good to talk with you, sir.
David, I'm always happy to be of help.
And it's always good to welcome back social media editor Wells Dunbar. Wells, what are you seeing online as the talk of Texas today?
Hey, David. Well, a major Texas school district might be all virtual until November due to COVID-19. Our home station KUT reports Austin ISD voted to delay the school year until September with online-only instruction until at least October and possibly into November. On our Facebook page, Dennis Gray calls the decision absurd. However, Amanda Cavazos-Weems says, I'm relieved that teachers and their union push to protect students, staff, and the community from a hasty reopening that could make the pandemic worse. I wish UT would show the same wisdom. Just one of the stories we're keeping an eye on this Friday, David. I'll be back with more takes from social media later in the broadcast.
Seemed like a lot of parents and others were concerned about why it took so long to kind of reach this decision on the part of the school board, but that's just part of a big conversation. We're going to have more on this and more Texas reactions in about 35 minutes or so as the Standard continues.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Association of Community Colleges, providing pathways for Texans to advance the individual aspirations of students while focusing on accessibility, affordability, and relevance. More at tacc.org.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Galveston Island, welcoming visitors back to the historic beach town while keeping safety in mind. Shopping, Gulf seafood, and family attractions like Moody Gardens and more. Details at galveston.com.
I'm Amy Miller, Program Director for KXT in North Texas, and you're listening to the Texas Standard. Live music streams have now become the norm for musicians, and there's no shortage of both free and ticketed concert streams on any given day. As music venues have been forced to adjust their business model, many of them continue to welcome artists into their space while making the shows available to fans at home. This weekend's quarantine streams offer up something for rock, country, and jazz fans alike, and as usual, you can watch them all from the comfort of your couch. The legendary Austin music venue, the Continental Club, has been hosting music for over 60 years now. And although its doors are closed until further notice, tonight they'll be hosting their first of many live streams. The concert will feature the Texas indie rock icon Ben Queller. No. Who has released a few new songs this past year and promises a new album soon. This will be Queller's first performance since the beginning of the pandemic, and on tap to open for him is songwriter Briston Maroney, who will be coming to you live from his living room in Nashville. The virtual doors open at 7:30, and you can find your ticket link at continentalclub.com.
Has been most every night beneath the
Our radio peers across the country, WXPN in Philadelphia, will continue their virtual music fest by reaching into their concert archives tomorrow, and the lineup will consist of all female musicians. Joining artists like Grace Potter, Amy Ray, and Sunflower Bean, Texas native Kacey Musgraves will headline the afternoon. With 6 Grammy Awards and 6 Country Music Association Awards, Musgraves has established herself as one of the leading voices in country and pop music today. You can catch this stellar lineup of ladies tomorrow at 11 a.m. Central Time at livesessions.npr.org.
No telling how many tears I've sat here and cried, or how many lies that I've lied, telling my poor heart he'll come back someday.
Rounding out the weekend, the Dallas-based organization Jazz Because will be hosting a free concert music stream on Sunday at 5 p.m. as part of its Pretty Amazing mini-concert series. Trumpeter Chris Boren has performed with such acts as the Polyphonic Spree, the Temptations, and the Tommy Dorsey Orchestra, and studied jazz at the renowned music school, the University of North Texas. He'll be joined in the lineup by current UNT student and bassist Anthony Capetto. You can stream their concert through the organization's Facebook page at facebook.com/jazzbecause. That's this Sunday at 5 p.m. I'm Amy Miller, and you're listening to the Texas Standard.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with essential workers who are out there working safe and keeping Texas strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Parents and children are spending more time together than ever before, but what about families that can't quarantine together, the ones that don't live under the same roof? Children in foster care often have weekly scheduled visits with their biological parents, but during the pandemic, some families in the Texas Child Protective Services system are not able to see each other in person. As Texas Standard intern Sarah Gabrielli reports, some parents have to visit their children in foster care virtually.
It's 4:45 on a Monday evening. Every week, this is the only time Cynthia Wright gets to see her son and daughter, ages 7 and 10. They're on the screen of her cell phone.
We only have FaceTime visits for an hour once a week, and I haven't seen my kids person-to-person in 3 months.
Their CPS case has been ongoing since around this time last year, based on charges of neglectful supervision after a domestic dispute between her and her husband. Wright lives in the Montgomery County seat of Conroe. Her kids live with a foster family in Houston, about 45 minutes south. But the pandemic makes separation that much more difficult.
Our visits are very good up until it's time to let go, and they just break down and cry. So us not being able to see each other, touch each other, or hug each other, it's really impacted all of us.
She believes that these video visits are not in her kids' best interest.
CPS and CASA, they're supposed to be for the kids. And they can literally see that they're hurting my kids worse than anything has ever hurt them in their life. And they are continuing to do it.
Wright says she sees other families within the Montgomery County court system that are able to meet in person, but the judge for her case ruled in favor of video visits. Statewide, social distancing policies for kids in CPS care and their parents differs by county and court. In Austin's Travis County, Judge Darlene Byrne oversees the CPS cases of around 1,600 kids, but she does not have a blanket policy for visitation.
Every situation is as unique as the DNA of every child I have on my docket. And so we have to treat it individually and try to ebb and flow with this virus in a healthy way while also trying to keep healthy family connections.
With each case, she has to consider all of the parties involved. For example, if a child is medically fragile or a parent is more exposed to the virus or the foster family is not comfortable with exposure. But most decisions in Travis County, whether to have video visits or meet in person, don't ever make it to Judge Byrne's bench.
We encourage the parties to reach agreements if they can and only bring contests to the court. So we don't try from a bench to micromanage every case. We rely on professionals, the legal attorneys, to advocate for them.
Another party involved in the process, the CPS caseworkers. This is Representative Marissa Gonzalez.
Our role, of course, is to make sure those visits happen, however we can get them to happen. So depending on what the court has ordered in that particular case, then we facilitate the visits, either in person or virtual. We're required to facilitate those visits the same way we always would.
For the families that are granted in-person visits, they meet at the CPS offices, but they aren't allowed to hug or touch each other either.
So we were making sure that we're following very strict cleaning protocols and social distancing guidelines so that those visits can happen in a safe manner.
After 3 months of video chatting, things finally changed for Cynthia Wright last Wednesday. The court granted a relative temporary custody, and now she can go back to visiting them in person whenever she pleases. I'm Sarah Gabrielli with the Texas Standard.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. An independent task force is reviewing Fort Hood's command climate and culture to identify causes behind its rising crime rates. Army Secretary Ryan McCarthy visited Thursday and said the civilian review will look at both the sprawling Central Texas base and surrounding community.
The numbers are high here. They are the highest in most cases for sexual assault and harassment and murders for our entire formation, U.S. Army. So we are getting an outside look to help us to get to those root causes and understand this so that we can make those changes.
8 soldiers have died at or near Fort Hood this year. That includes Army Specialist Vanessa Guillen, whose murder has spurred widespread calls for addressing sexual misconduct in the military. Hidalgo County residents are under stay-at-home orders for another 12 days as COVID-19 cases continue surging in the Rio Grande Valley. County Judge Rich Cortez extended the restrictions Wednesday, which include a curfew from 10 p.m. to 5 a.m. Cortez explains the order is needed to keep people out of local hospitals, which have been overwhelmed.
Because if you want to see misery, go to any one of those hospitals and just hear the cries of people yelling that they can't breathe.
743 people have died in Hidalgo County alone. Statewide, the official death toll rose by 306 on Thursday to 7,803 people. Those include more than 3,000 fatalities in the past 2 weeks. Texas Republican Party Chairman Alan West is the latest to criticize Governor Greg Abbott for relying on his executive powers to manage the ongoing public health crisis. In an interview with Empower Texans Thursday, the former Florida congressman called on the Republican governor to convene a special legislative session.
So you have that very specific period of time, I believe in the Texas Constitution is 30 to 45 days, where you can act under emergency orders. But then when you want to continue on, it's important that you do bring the legislature in, because that is that key in the checks and balances.
Republicans in several Texas counties have censured Abbott over his order requiring Texans to wear face coverings. And Texas Tech University has fired its women's basketball coach following a report she fostered a toxic environment for players. The Raiders athletics director announced Marlene Stollings' termination Thursday. The day before, USA Today reported on years of abuse alleged by former team members that included punishing players for not sustaining near maximum heart rates during games and threatening comments and sexually suggestive behavior from a former strength coach. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
You're listening to statewide news from public radio stations across Texas. This coverage is only possible because of support from listeners like you. You can help sustain and grow Texas news coverage by donating to your local public radio station.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. A state parks official once famously claimed the top three conservation issues in Texas are water, water, and water. As we've reported here recently, experts say the next 100 years in Texas are likely to be drier than any time in the last 1,000 years. Now, the news organization Circle of Blue, which reports on issues related to H2O worldwide, has launched a series of reports about the challenges Texas faces trying to manage what many argue is the Lone Star State's most precious resource. Former New York Times journalist Keith Schneider is senior editor and chief correspondent with CircleofBlue.org, which this week launched the month-long series Water Texas. Keith, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you so much.
Tell us a little bit about why Texas caught your organization's attention here and what exactly you were looking to tell the story of.
Well, Circle of Blue has traveled the nation and the world to report on one of the seminal struggles between the economy and the environment of our century, which is the confrontation between rising demand for water. And Texas is one of those places where this confrontation is most apparent and most severe. Texas is a growing state. By 2070, we'll have 51 million people. So Texas is going to have a significant confrontation between rising demand because of population and economic growth and diminishing supply. So, and Texas is also, you know, our second largest state.
I think that what's interesting to me is that we seem to be always sort of lurching from crisis to crisis when it comes to the issue of water. As you've been reporting on water in Texas, do you see a way out of that cycle?
Changes of this magnitude take generations. It took generations to build the interstate highway system. It took generations to build the big dams across the West to provide water. So Texas needs now to begin, or at least to advance, the work that it's already been doing over the last several decades to reduce its water demand and at the same time cultivate the industries that use less water or can use less water.
It seems like quite often when we talk about water in Texas, we're talking about it at the extremes. We're talking about the troubles that the cities are facing. We're talking about the parched conditions out west. Texas Hill Country isn't a place where we often talk about water, but as you're pointing out, it seems like we're having more challenges, more clashes, really, over water there, right?
The Hill Country is the epicenter of the confrontation between rising demand and diminishing supplies of fresh water. And if you look at Hays County, two generations ago, Hays County had 40,000 people in it and 14,000 residential homes. It now has 220,000 people in it and 75,000 homes. So I started our series at Jacob's Wells in Wimberley. Jacob's Well is this famed artesian well that actually had been running unmolested, untrammeled, plenty of water for centuries, and then began to run dry. And it's episodic in droughts. And as Hays County grows and other Hill Country counties grow in population, there is already during droughts severe water shortage, severe crimping in the water supply, which is going to affect every aspect of the quality of life in that region. We also have in Texas agriculture.
I was going to say, of course, agriculture accounts for something like 60% of all water consumption in Texas.
Yes, agriculture is very much aware of this. Farmers have been water conservers for decades in Texas and are doing a decent job. But again, the supply, there's going to be changes in agriculture too, changes in cropping patterns, changes in what kinds of crops are cultivated, changes in how water is delivered to agriculture and to crops. There could be, you know, changes in practices and laws about how how to share water in Texas. These are major changes that are happening this century that nature is just going to insist occur, or Texas's quality of life will diminish.
What is it that you're hoping to accomplish ultimately with this month-long series of stories on Texas and water? How do you see it making a difference?
You know, our work is designed to just illustrate a major confrontation and then to pick out, choose, and show and display and report on the places and the people that are making change. One of our stories is on the $1.9 trillion Texas economy and the incredible influence that water has through all of it. And that economy is endangered in its current form unless it adjusts to a more water-conserving regime. And it can be done. Our purpose is to try to dig into, you know, the complexity of these stories and then unravel them in narratives that are compelling and in pictures that are compelling, graphics that are compelling.
Keith Schneider is senior editor and chief correspondent with Circle of Blue. They have a new series that launched this week on Water, Texas. We'll have a link to it over at texasstandard.org. Keith, great to talk with you. Thanks so much for taking time out to speak with us on The Standard.
Thank you.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas ABLE program, a tax advantage savings program helping eligible Texans with disabilities save for the future. Learn more, including how the program works with certain public benefits, at texasable.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, offering annual preventative and screening appointments with safety protocols in place. Early detection is critical to better cancer outcomes. More at texasoncology.com.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Whether in the form of tweet outbursts or major speeches, Donald Trump's political rhetoric has been picked apart in real time and analyzed in countless essays and so-called think pieces. Many have called his rhetoric dark and divisive. It's been called inflammatory and other words, too. But is it also, in a sense, genius? A new book from a Texas rhetoric expert argues that perhaps it is. It's called Demagogue for President: The Rhetorical Genius of Donald Trump. Joining us now, the book's author, Jennifer Murcia. She is associate professor in the Department of Communication at Texas A&M University. Professor Murcia, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
I'm so glad to be here. Thank you.
Now, before we get into President Trump's strategies that you take a closer look at here, I want to ask you a bit about how this project actually came about and, more specifically, how you sort of became one of the go-to experts in the country on analyzing President Trump's rhetoric. I mean, what was the path that led you here specifically when it comes to talking about Trump's verbal tactics or pyrotechnics?
Yeah, I never planned to get in the Trump business, and sometimes I wish I weren't here. But I started writing an essay in 2009 about the history of demagogues in the United States. I was really interested in the relationship between rhetoric and democracy and demagogues or leaders of the people and who we accused of being a demagogue and why, and really just interested in that kind of issue. And I had what I thought were some great pages written, but I couldn't finish it because I really thought that there would be like a new kind of demagogue who used spectacle and public relations and propaganda. And we didn't really have that person until Donald Trump started his presidential campaign. And then almost immediately, Lindsey Graham called him a demagogue. And so from that time on, I've been paying attention to Trump's rhetoric and, you know, what I thought about it.
Well, now let me pause on that word demagogue, because that in and of itself can be polarizing. We've heard about the repeated overuse of certain things like fascist have, in a sense, devalued such a term. We've heard demagogue used quite a bit on both sides of the political aisle. As you mentioned, Senator Graham of South Carolina, a Republican himself. What is a demagogue as you define it?
Yeah, so the literal translation of the word means a leader of the people. And it makes sense that in a democracy that someone would emerge from the people and lead. So that's a good thing in a lot of ways. And so I think it's useful to distinguish between what I think of as heroic demagogues, so people who are leaders of the people, demagogues who lead justly, who are accountable to the will of the people, and demagogues who are dangerous. And those are unaccountable leaders, demagogues who use polarizing propaganda for their own gain.
You divide this group into three sections: Trump and the distrusting electorate, Trump and the polarized electorate, and Trump and the frustrated electorate. Why break them down into three categories of electorate? And what exactly were you trying to point out? How the president exploited these factions to his advantage?
Yeah, that's right. So in 2015, and certainly since, the United States has been facing a historic crisis of political stability. We are distrusting, we are polarized, we are frustrated. If you ask people if the nation is headed in the right direction or the wrong track, they say the wrong track. They don't trust political institutions or traditional political leadership or the media. It's a real problem. And Donald Trump used rhetorical strategies that were designed to take advantage of pre-existing distrust, polarization, and frustration.
I suppose the most obvious, I want to focus on the frustrated electorate for just a moment. There are a lot of people who have lost their jobs or been displaced by shifts in the global economic situation. Give us an example of a rhetorical strategy that the president has used to try to cement his power.
Yeah, absolutely. And people are not wrong to be frustrated. That's not wrong. What's wrong is the way that Trump took advantage of it. And so, you know, one of the things that he would always say is America is losing, we're losers. And then he would blame existing leadership, right? So trying to increase that distrust. And he would say, you know, they're all in it on this conspiracy. They're out to get you. I'm the only one who can solve these problems. You know, I'm the only one who can make America great again. And then really lauding his people as the best of America.
But there's an interesting thing that you just mentioned, his people. It's hard to escape this idea of us versus them in a lot of the president's rhetoric, especially when it comes to identity and questions of race.
Yeah, absolutely. Trump really leaned in on that us-them polarization. He really constitutes his people as the most patriotic, the smartest, the best, and it's an ad populum appeal. So he uses his people as a cudgel. He wields them against his adversaries. He says, my people are the greatest and the smartest, and I am the leader of my people, so therefore I am the greatest and the smartest. And he gets his people to attack his opponents, and he really uses these divisive strategies repeatedly.
By saying my people, what does he mean? Now, I know that this has been deconstructed at great length in the newspapers over the past three and a half more years, really, when you get right down to it. But what is he saying with my people?
Well, there's definitely a racial element to it. One of the interesting sort of subplots in my book is I trace out how a lot of narratives emerged in Trump's rhetoric that started in, you know, what we would consider the right-wing fringe. So conspiracy theorists like InfoWars and Alex Jones, or, white nationalists like those on Daily Stormer. And they have very specific agendas, right, about creating a white nation, about eliminating those in power, whatnot. And Trump repeatedly used what we call narrative laundering. So it's like money laundering, but for storylines and plots and frames. And he recirculated and amplified this content over and over and over again while denying responsibility for it. So it's really difficult to hold Trump accountable for his words and actions, and part of it is the rhetorical strategies that he uses.
Ultimately, what is it that you hope readers will take away from this book if you're reaching out to the general public here?
My hope is that people will be able to understand these rhetorical strategies, will be able to see them being used in real time, And, you know, to decide for themselves what they think. I mean, Trump told us repeatedly not to pay attention to how he speaks. He said it was just mere political correctness, that concern over his tone was ridiculous and was something that only women would care about. And at the same time, he told us that he was the greatest, you know, communicator and that he was a rhetorical genius. And I think it matters how he talks. And I think that it matters for democracy. And so what I'm hoping is that people will be able to recognize these strategies. They're easy to see once you understand them, and that they'll decide for themselves what they think about them.
Jennifer Murcia has been talking about her new book, Demagogue for President, The Rhetorical Genius of Donald Trump. She's associate professor in the Department of Communication at Texas A&M University, specializing in political rhetoric. Professor, as always, a pleasure to speak with you, and thanks for your time.
Thank you so much.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, proud to be a founding sponsor of the Texas Standard on public radio. Texas Mutual is a policyholder-owned workers' comp provider working to bring wellness into the workplace. More at WorkSafeTexas.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at RaiseYourHandTexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools.
I'm Jody Edgerton with Typewriter Rodeo. We create custom poems on vintage typewriters. You give us a word, a phrase, anything you like, and we create a poem for you on the spot. Work meetings in the time of coronavirus. Let's dive in on our agenda. Just pretend we're together, like normal. It's great to see your faces again. Judith, love the painting behind you. Ben, maybe make your bed before our next call. Or, you know, try one of those virtual backgrounds. Oh, great, the Death Star is an improvement. First item, a check-in from marketing. Oh, can everyone mute yourselves? Mute? Click mute? I think I am definitely hearing someone crunching chips. Please mute. You know what? Let's call this a success. I loved seeing your cats and appreciate no one standing up because I know you're all wearing pajama pants. Let's try again Monday. Go team. Meeting adjourned. I'm Jody Edgerton with Typewriter Rodeo, and you're listening to Texas Standard.
Support for the Typewriter Rodeo comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
You can catch the Typewriter Rodeo each Friday here on The Standard, anytime on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And make sure to send us your Typewriter Rodeo requests on social media or email us, texasstandard@kut.org. We can't wrap up the big broadcast on this Friday without first talking politics with Alex Samuels, reporter for the Texas Tribune. Alex, good to speak with you again.
Yes, always happy to be here.
Less than 90 days now until Election Day, and this week you were writing about how the Trump campaign is trying to appeal to black voters. How's that going in Texas, and what's the campaign doing exactly?
Yeah, so I went to a Black Voices for Trump event up in Waco. This was actually back in February, so pre-pandemic. And what I found sort of ironic was that the only Black people there were myself and the speaker. So it really just speaks to the issues that the GOP might have courting Black voters and voters of color, especially as we get closer to the election.
You know, I think a lot of people who've been following this administration and its rhetoric, and especially that of the previous election cycle, might well wonder, how does the Trump campaign think it can court black voters this go around? What's the pitch? What's the message?
So really, you know, surrogates from the event were trying to play up what Trump has done with criminal justice reform, money he's given to historically black colleges and universities. They're really trying to flip the narrative and say, you know, Democrats are the party of racists, not Republicans. You know, really just trying to tout that message and show what Trump has been doing for black and Latino voters.
Earlier in the broadcast, we were talking about Joe Biden getting a lot of pressure from Democrats in Texas to turn up the heat here in the Lone Star State, because there's a sense that he may actually have a chance to pull off a victory in November. And for the campaign itself, the Biden campaign, the former vice president has been doing some hiring here in Texas. Tell us about those hires.
So his state director will be Rebecca Acuna, who is a veteran of the Texas Capitol and Democratic campaigns in the state. And Biden's deputy state director will be Jen Longoria, who led Elizabeth Warren's campaign in Texas during the primary.
I wonder how significant those hires are, especially considering that both are Latinas.
Right. It really just marks another sign of the Biden campaign's commitment to Texas, especially as the state increasingly looks like a November battleground. Of course, Trump carried Texas by 9 percentage points in 2016, but all recent polls indicate that the race will be a lot closer this November.
Let's talk a little bit about a Senate race, which is appearing to be a whole lot closer than a lot of folks predicted just a few months ago. John Cornyn's trying to hang on to his seat against Democratic challenger MJ Hager. And now that she's pulling up in the polls, it appears she's getting quite a financial boost from the National Party.
So the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee announced this week that it will spend at least $1 million to help MJ and her challenge to Cornyn. According to the DSCC, this is the first time that they've made a coordinated investment in a general election in Texas. So the money will go toward TV ads, polling, and other campaign resources.
So an historic move unto itself. Read all about it over at texastribune.org, where Alex Samuels is political reporter. Alex, thanks so much for getting us up to speed.
Yes, thanks for having me.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Weekend's almost here. Let's get one more check-in with our social media editor, Wells Dunbar. Wells, you sound somewhat relieved there, man.
Working for the weekend, David, working for the weekend. Well, sticking with Texas politics just a bit longer, that was an eyebrow-raising story we heard midway through the show in the news roundup. The new leader of the Texas Republican Party, former Tea Party Representative Alan West, has some choice words for Republican Governor Greg Abbott. He told the media arm of arch-conservative group Empower Texans that he supports a special session of the Texas legislature to deal with the state's COVID-19 precautions, which so far have fallen under the executive power of the governor there. Interesting turn of events there, judging by some of the reactions we're seeing on Facebook there. Craig Anders York calls it an interesting story and interesting rhetoric from the new Texas chair. It makes me wonder if he plans to run against Abbott eventually. And I've seen some other reports from political commentators noting, or rather asking, if this sort of intra-party beef, if you will, is what the party needs 3 months away from a tough election. Yeah, hard to believe. Only less than 90 days away at this point in time.
Yeah, it is hard to believe.
You know, another story on social media about social media, this one happening late yesterday, President Trump using emergency economic powers to effectively ban TikTok amid questions about the data collected by that Chinese-owned social video app. The order is set to take effect in 45 days. And the background here is how this may affect TikTok's potential sale to Microsoft. So a lot of variables to this story. TikTok, a relatively new entrant in the social media realm, but one very popular with the youths, with the Zoomers and such. So speaking of those kids, Linda Lloyd on Facebook asks if those TikTok kids who are old enough to vote might notice this come election day. And a sort of interesting wrinkle there, too. It was unclear who exactly this affected at first. The parent company of the company that owns TikTok, Tencent, is this mega player in the world of mobile and social apps. Fortnite, League of Legends, these very popular games. So for a moment, it looked like the order might have affected all of those. But they, I guess there's been some clarity from the White House. Now it's just applying to the company behind TikTok. So obviously a developing story there with a pretty big ramifications, I might say.
Yes, indeed. In fact, right now, Politico is reporting that President Trump might take some unilateral action to extend some kind of relief on student loan payments. But there's a whole lot in play. You can keep up with all the news 24/7 over at texasstandard.org. And we'll be back on Monday. I believe Laura Rice will be in the host chair. Hope you can join us then. Have a great weekend.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington family. Would your company or organization like to be a sponsor as well? Contact your local station for opportunities within your community. For statewide sponsorships, visit TexasPublicMediaNetwork.com.